You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about a statewide project that uses objects and artifacts to reveal Wisconsin's history.
First, there have been a lot of headlines over the last several months about antibiotic resistance, including the news a few weeks ago that the first strain of bacteria resistant to antibiotics of last resort was discovered in the U.S.
But antibiotic resistance is a complicated and nuanced issue, and you may not have the full picture. Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine is with us for a rundown of everything you need to know about this topic and more.
Gemma's senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us once a month to talk about the coolest science headlines of the day. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, and I am going to talk really fast today to make sure you get everything worth knowing.
Well, we're going to start out with something pretty cool and also kind of puzzling. There apparently is a new maybe geologic formation in Upper Michigan that has got a lot of people stumped. What do we know about that?
Yes, and you know, I love the story because the researcher is such a character. So overnight, literally, this geological formation appeared up in the northern part of the UP, and basically, it was like the earth split in two for about the length of a football field. And no one could figure out what it was, so Wayne Pennington from Michigan Technological University, he is a geophysicist there, he went up and, you know, he admits that he was just thinking it was going to be a landslide or something not particularly sexy, so he actually stopped by the site on his way back from a conference, and he was wearing, like, his dress shoes, and he was not ready to be tromping around in the swampy woods. But he figured out it's actually a pop-up, and this is a really unusual formation to find there, because pop-ups happen when the rock layers spring up suddenly after a weight has been removed. And if you think about a glacier retreating, after the huge weight of the glacier gets off the ground, that the rock layers beneath will spring up in a pop-up. So the question is, what is it doing in the UP? And they figured out, they kind of went through this whole puzzle, and they're not really 100% sure, but they did figure out that it may have had something to do with road work years ago, and then a large tree finally toppling over, and just the combined effect, voila, strange geological formation you don't expect to find in the UP.
So I have to say, we think of geological events as being millennia in the past, but this is something that's just happened.
Yes, kaboom, overnight. There you go.
So
you know, a lot of times after an earthquake, you'll see, you know, the very dramatic footage of, you know, the roads shifting or a house's foundation dropping several feet. And this is basically on that scale. It is that substantive. And overnight, no one expected it. There's no geological faults in the area. Just, boop, there it is.
So it seems like it's fairly, although it does happen, like you said, with earthquakes and the like, but it seems like this is kind of an amazing opportunity for scientists to be able to study something as it happened.
Yeah, this is, as far as the researchers involved know, this is the only naturally occurring pop-up that they have found under these circumstances. Again, in a place like a quarry or in the wake of a retreating glacier, you may find them, but this is the only time they've actually been able to say, yes, at this hour and this date and this time, boom, the pop-up happened.
We're getting the latest in science news with Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. And Gemma, this month Discover has created a large section and it's called Everything You Need to Know. What's the idea behind that new section?
Yes, this is our special. It's the first time we're doing this. It's called the Everything Worth Knowing issue. And we took a couple dozen topics and just, you know, if you're at a dinner party, or if you're talking to a colleague, you know, casually, every now and then someone will say, oh, I heard about stem cell research, or oh, they discovered this new black hole. And let's face it, you know, you cannot possibly be up to date on every single topic. So what we did was just basically in 2 to 4 pages per topic, we really wanted to give people kind of just a baseline so that if you hear a story on the news, say, about stem cell research, you don't have to ask yourself, oh my gosh, what is that? You can really just refer to this, have a baseline, and be like, oh yeah, I know what they're talking about. And then, you know, you'll be able to absorb the news of the discovery or the new treatment right away without worrying about kind of the basics.
I have to say, I think a lot of Wisconsin trivia teams are going to be doing a lot better thanks to this feature. Well, let's dig into some of these topics. What do we need to know about that antibiotic resistance that we mentioned?
Well, you know, I think the thing we all know already about antibiotic resistance is that it is a big issue and it's a scary issue. But the good news is there are some really smart people making advances and moving us past this, you know, doom of antibiotic resistance. There are some really interesting treatments and some things, they're still experimental. They're not, you know, available from your doctor yet, but it's not quite as hopeless as I think some of the headlines make it seem when you hear, oh, this new resistant and a, you know, resistant bacteria is going to doom us all. It doesn't happen. We're working our way through it. Science is going to save us. I'm confident.
Well, let's hopscotch over to one of your favorite topics, Gemma. This is close to your heart, the study of human origins. And what is the latest there?
Yeah, the latest is that we don't know everything. that's been the case for a long time. And there are some things we do know, like we can chart some a basic family tree. But the more research we do, the more fossils we find, the more that tree looks like a bush rather than, you know, like a really tall, stately pine with one pinnacle, that being us. So we talked to a lot of different researchers, and the really exciting thing happening now in the field is that they're able to push further and further back how far they can sequence DNA, residual DNA found in some of these fossils. You know, it seems like every year they double the age of the fossil that they can actually sequence the DNA. And that's important because that's going to tell us a lot about the relationships between species. So it's a really exciting time to be in the field. And, of course, they're finding brand new stuff. I mean, you remember last year, Homo naledi, this brand new species, mm-hmm. they found tons of examples of it in South Africa.
And what are the next steps in figuring out the map of that bush of human existence?
Well, you know, like I said, they're always improving the ability to look backwards, genetically speaking, but it's still incredibly complicated. Like, you know, I think there's a 12,000-year-old infant whose DNA they were able to sequence a couple of years ago, and talking to the researcher who did it, he said 98% of the material in their sample was bacterial contamination. So only 2% of their sample was actually the DNA of the individual that they then were able to sequence, and it's a very complicated process. Mm-hmm. But the good news is we're getting better and better at it, and I think that's really the wave to the future, although we are still finding new fossils too, which is super cool.
Now, to touch on another topic that you cover in this new section of the magazine is creativity. What's the cutting edge of creativity?
Well, the exciting thing is, you know, I think a lot of people have been, oh, I'm not a creative person. Oh, you know, that person's so much more creative than I am. But scientists have actually found a number of attributes that mark creativity, but also ways you can spark your own creativity. And it's about having an open-minded personality and also having low latent inhibition levels, which is, again, kind of tied to the open personality. But also, there are really actually steps that you can take to make yourself more creative and improve your creative process. And it's everything from heading outdoors. Actually, spending time outdoors is associated with physiological changes that improve creative thought in the brain. So it's stuff like that, it's stuff like meditating, and you know, sometimes it's stuff like just doing it, just being willing to, you know, jump on that stage and take the mic in your hand and do some karaoke and just not care how it sounds. And that's a lot of what's behind the creative process.
Well, I'm one of those people that would say that I'm not very creative, but I'm also a kind person, so I'm not going to subject anyone to my singing. But maybe I'll head outdoors. And now it's summer. People are heading to the beach. You've just written about sharks. What are some of your favorite shark facts?
Well, first, don't fear the sharks, okay? We are much more of a threat as a species than sharks. And speaking of species, there are about 500 known species of shark. You can find them everywhere from sort of brackish water estuaries all the way to 10,000 feet below the sea level. So it's exciting. They're all over the place. There's so many different kinds, and they're just fascinating animals that are, you know, 455 million years old.
The different variety of sharks sort of blew my mind. You write about in this piece both a shark that can fit in the palm of your hand and the oldest shark, which I guess is a goblin shark, and a shark that could swallow you if it were inclined to eat people, the whale shark. What did you learn about just the different kinds of sharks, Gemma?
Well, you know, one of the things that blew my mind talking about size is that if you're at all a shark fan, you know that, you know, Megalodon was kind of the big guy. He's been extinct about 2.6 million years, but Megalodon was just absolutely enormous, more than 50 feet long. And just reading this one paper that came out in 2010 about paleontologists uncovering this 10-million-year-old megalodon nursery. And so they're describing all the fossils, and the fossils are like, we found a newborn that was 6.2 feet long.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh, the newborn is taller than I am.
Wow. Well, Gemma, thanks so much for being with us. It was fascinating as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, which is based right in Wisconsin in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about the latest big science headlines.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump has pushed for mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. We talk about how a Trump presidency could affect the dairy industry, which relies heavily on immigrant labor.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Look around you right now. That hat, that book, that jacket you're wearing. What do those objects say about your history? Wisconsin 101 is a statewide history project to explore Wisconsin's history through objects. First up is historian Sergio Gonzalez, sharing a poster advertising a 1904 concert from a well-known Milwaukee musician.
This object is an advertisement for a music recital performed by a man named Rafael Baez and his wife, Megan Sean Baez, and they were performing at the Athenaeum. This was around the turn of the century in 1904. And this object is special because Rafael Baez is one of the first documented Mexicans to have made his home in Milwaukee. Rafael Baez was a classically trained musician in Mexico, and he was actually recruited by a company called the C.D. Hess Opera Company. He did a tour through Mexico, and after he finished his musical tour, the company recruited him to come to Milwaukee, and he ended up making his home here in the late 1880s. At the turn of the century, Milwaukee had a really rich and vibrant musical culture. It was actually one of the cultural hotspots for the United States because of their rich German heritage. They were actually known as the Deutsche Athens of America. And so posters like this would actually be scattered throughout the city any day of the week at the turn of the century. He was trained as a violinist. He was a composer, and he eventually became the musical director of various churches throughout Milwaukee, and he was actually the first documented Mexican origin professor at Marquette University. He was a professor of music. So he came in the 1880s, and the first real wave of Mexican migration didn't happen until the 1920s. So there's actually this gap between when he came and the next wave. The first real wave of Mexican immigrants came in the 1920s as industrial workers. They were actually initially recruited by the Fiston Vogel Tannery Company to work in tanneries, and eventually they settled throughout the city south side throughout the 1920s. In the Milwaukee Journal, the Milwaukee Sentinel carried advertisements of his work, and there are always glowing reviews of his concerts. He was well-respected within the musical community, and his work was, you know, his concerts were generally covered very well by the newspapers. He decided to make his home here after touring with this opera company, so I would imagine that his experience was a pleasant one in Milwaukee, and he was able to make a life for himself and for his family to the point that he wanted to stay here for the rest of his life. Since I'm a historian, I think there's just a certain amount of significance in identifying the community that has existed and understanding that the community has been there longer than historians might imagine beyond the 1920s. I think this object is also significant because it gives us a different story for what immigration history we usually think of, especially with Mexican immigration to the city. Baez was a middle class worker who was he was recruited to come here as kind of a skilled worker, what we would today recognize as a highly skilled worker. And he contributed a lot to the city's cultural history and the cultural background of the city. He trained a lot of musicians who went on to have careers within the city and within the country. And I think that within itself is a big contribution to Milwaukee's history.
That story is part of Wisconsin 101, a collaborative history project from historians, students, and residents to explore our history in objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and find us on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Our next guests have been working on a statewide history project that explores Wisconsin's history through specific artifacts and objects collected from people all over the state. Here to tell us more about the collaborative project is Sarah Thal, an associate professor of history at UW-Madison, and Adam Mandelman, managing editor of Wisconsin 101. Sarah, Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks.
So where did this idea come from, telling the history of Wisconsin through these specific objects?
Well, Tom Broman, the other co-director of Wisconsin 101, who's in the History of Science Department at UW-Madison, he and I were working together to improve undergraduate education in the history department and history-related fields. And we're always trying to figure out a way to make history more exciting and more relevant for our students. And we thought, well, you know, what could we do to make this more interesting? And this was also at a time when the people of Wisconsin seemed very divided, and there were a lot of questions about what is the worth of the humanities for studying and for students. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, we want to do something about Wisconsin. We want students to get excited about doing research. We have the wonderful Wisconsin Historical Society right nearby. Why not get students researching things about Wisconsin and writing things for the public? And then we thought, you know, this shouldn't just be people in Madison saying this is what the history of Wisconsin is. This should be people throughout the state telling their own histories. And what is most evocative from people's lives, that's objects. Those are things, mm-hmm. the things we hold, the things we make, the things we use and trade with each other. And so we came up with this idea of telling the history of Wisconsin through objects and asking people to tell their own histories of their own objects that they find meaningful. And then we would use those on a website and then on Wisconsin Life to try to show how the many different lives of people of Wisconsin are connected to each mm-hmm. other through the things they make, the things they buy, the things they use.
So, Adam, just looking around the studio where we're sitting, there are probably hundreds of items right here in this room, but not all of them have kind of a shared meaning or represent something larger than themselves. How do you decide what objects are worth collecting to represent Wisconsin?
That's a really good question. one of the sort of pitfalls that people run into sometimes when proposing an object for the project is we sort of tend to really emphasize things in our culture when thinking about history that are text or images, you know, so photographs or diary entries or newspapers. And so sometimes people get a little hung up on things that we sort of immediately think about in historical terms and forget that objects should tell their own stories. So we're looking for objects that are interesting and maybe visually compelling, but that also point directly to themselves, that they're not symbolizing something else. So like a monument or historical marker would be kind of mm-hmm. a bad object, right? We want something like a bowling pin, for example, that's on our site right now that tells readers and visitors to the site all about how Wisconsin or Milwaukee became the bowling capital of America for some time, or how the bowling industry landed in northern Wisconsin in part because of the rich lumbering history mm-hmm. of the state. So usually we're looking for objects that tell their own stories rather than pointing at or symbolizing something else. And then also, while we want everyone to tell their sort of their own experiences of Wisconsin history through objects, we want, you know, a reader in Bayfield to be able to connect to a story that's from Milwaukee, or a reader in Janesville to connect to a story in La Crosse. So, you know, sometimes that old object in your grandmother's basement might have a a statewide story, but not always. So we're looking for that sort of broader context sometimes too.
So you mentioned the Vulcan bowling pin. What about the Penguin hot and cold server? What is that?
So that's a really great object that was produced in the 1940s out of West Bend, Wisconsin, from an aluminum production company that began in the first decade of the 20th century. And originally they were producing aluminum cookware and then got wrapped up in the war effort. But then when war production ceased, they started returning to housewares, and they produced this thing called the Penguin Hot and Cold Server, which it has a penguin motif. But it was used to present chilled food or hot food to guests, and became actually really integral into the rise of cocktail parties and barbecuing and those other aspects of post-war American culture.
So it's a real part of cultural history.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Sarah, how can people get involved with this? What's the best way for people to connect personally with the project?
There are several ways. One of the first ways is to check out our website, which is wi101.org. And you can browse the stories and just start wandering through them wherever you feel like going. And then you can click on
there are a few areas of the website where you can add your email address and subscribe to updates. And then really importantly, there's a whole section where you can learn about how to contribute your own stories as well.
And, you know, it's great to see images of these objects, but are there going to be any events where people can actually see the objects in person?
Well, that's an interesting question. It is a virtual exhibit. So all of these objects are actually housed at their home historical societies. Mm. But
or in people's attics.
Right.
Some people write about their own objects.
Right. But we do conduct events throughout the state, reaching out to people, telling them about the project, telling them how they can get involved, and inviting them to participate in various ways of their own.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah and Adam, for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Thal is an associate professor of history at UW-Madison, and Adam Mandelman is the managing editor of Wisconsin 101.
Coming up, we talk about how Donald Trump's stance on immigration and deportations could affect the dairy industry in Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up at 7 on Reveal, they take a closer look at PCBs, compounds that were used widely in school building materials such as window caulk. They were banned in 1979, but still pose a serious health risk to kids today.
First, Wisconsin is one of the largest producers of dairy in the country. It's an industry that depends a lot on the labor of immigrants. Some estimates say that more than half of the workers in the dairy industry are immigrants who are undocumented.
Presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump has vowed to pursue mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. That stance is raising serious concerns among some dairy farmers in Wisconsin and beyond.
Joining me now is Mark Niket. He's the national government and politics reporter for Bloomberg News. His article about the possible implications of Donald Trump's position on immigrants is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first off, what concerns did you hear from dairy businesses and workers about Donald Trump's plan to deport possibly millions of undocumented workers?
Well, I first became aware of these concerns in the Wisconsin primary before the voting on April 5th, where farmers were in public sessions asking Mr. Trump and Ted Cruz, who was in the race at the time, you know, how their policies would affect them. And the concerns are that, you know, essentially deporting all undocumented immigrants, but also building the wall, as Donald Trump has proposed, and limiting legal immigration to give preference for jobs to unemployed Americans, as he states, it would essentially eliminate the ability of dairy farmers to hire the kind of the number of workers they need to milk their cows. Essentially, they say, you know, particularly as smaller dairy farms have consolidated or merged with other operations, that they just can't hire enough local workers or use family members to milk their cows. So they have to rely on these immigrants to do the work. They'd like to give preference to Americans if they'd be willing to do the job, but, you know, they can't find those workers. So their concern is that these immigration proposals from Donald Trump would, you know, severely limit their ability to run their operations.
Why is the dairy industry being possibly especially hit hard by this as opposed to other areas of the farming industry?
Other agricultural operations also would be affected. It's just sort of a fact of life in our country that a lot of our agricultural field work in particular is done by immigrants. The American Farm Bureau Federation estimates that 80% of all agricultural workers across the country, including dairy farmers, are immigrant labor, and 70% of those workers are undocumented. So it's just a function of the type of work. These are, you know, very hard jobs, a lot of entry-level work, and it's just the way these operations work. They rely on immigrant labor.
And how important are immigrants to the dairy industry? What kind of numbers do we have?
Well, as you said in your intro, estimates are between 50 and 60% of all immigrants working at Wisconsin dairy farms are undocumented. And if you look across the country, about a third of all U.S. dairy farms employed foreign-born workers in 2014. This is from a survey that Milk Producers commissioned from Texas A&M University. And they found that over half of all dairy farm workers across the country were immigrants. Now, that would be both undocumented and documented immigrants.
So for some in Wisconsin, you look at the political aspects of this, and some of these, the dairy farmers and the dairy business, seem to be people who would vote conservative, would vote with the GOP, but some of them at least are having second thoughts given this possibility about immigration action from Donald Trump. What did you hear?
Yeah, it's kind of a generalization, but, you know, farmers tend to be conservative, and a lot of them lean Republican. And I talked to a lot of dairy farmers in Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania, sort of these key Midwestern states that Donald Trump really wants to do well and thinks he can sort of flip from Democrat to Republican in the presidential election, and asked them, you know, how do you view the presidential race? And a lot of them said, well, you know, normally I vote Republican, but this year I'm not so sure. I quoted some in my story saying, you know, that they'd still vote for Trump because they think he'd be better than Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee. But some said outright that they're not sure they could support Trump based on his immigration stand alone. It's that important to their business, and they just don't want to take that risk of having those policies implemented. And one of the things you'll hear is that, you know, it's just it's not realistic for Trump to get these policies enacted, that it would be hard to do, get through Congress, just logistically you can't deport all undocumented immigrants, building a wall would be hard to do, and so forth. But I think the concern is, even if you don't enact the specifics of what he's talking about, it could have a chilling effect on the number of immigrants who do come to this country to work, and limit the ability of dairy farms in particular to get the kind of number of workers they need.
We're talking with Mark Niquette right now. He's the national government and politics reporter for Bloomberg News. And we're talking about the possible implications of Donald Trump's position on immigration on the dairy industry in Wisconsin and beyond. And before we get to the effects on consumers and the price of milk, Mark, why is it that the dairy industry, those doing the hiring, why can't they find, as quote-unquote American workers, to fill these jobs?
Well, I think they're hard jobs to begin with. I mean, milking cows, you know, dairy operations are 24 hours a day, 365 days. The cow's got to be milked three times a day, which means you have to have three shifts of workers generally. And that means, you know, long hours, early hours, weekends. You know, these are not easy jobs, and the conditions can be somewhat monotonous to do this work, you know, over, say, an eight-hour shift. So, you know, other jobs are easier to do than this, so that's one reason. But I think there's also a sense that, you know, you just can't get enough workers at that entry level to do this type of work, that it's easier for folks to go work, you know, at McDonald's or somewhere else where the pay might not be as high or even above the minimum wage. And one of the things these farmers say is, you know, they offer salary and benefits that match or exceed, you know, other industries in the area. And I think because of the nature of the job, primarily, they just can't get enough of the folks they need for their operations. And, you know, that's not to say they're not trying. You know, they advertise in the papers locally and, you know, recruit where they can. But, you know, they just have a certain number of jobs they have to fill, and they can't get them all locally.
Right. And I think in your piece you say a lot of the times the pay is something like $11, and there might even be a 401k involved.
Right. I talked to a lot of these farmers who said, you know, after 6 months you can get, you know, paid vacation time, 401k, uniform allowance. And this survey I mentioned from Texas A&M University found that the average pay across the country was $11.54 an hour with benefits, including health care, and that comes out to about $35,000 a year. So the argument is, you know, the pay isn't great, right? It's hard to live off that, particularly if you have a family. But if you're at an entry-level job, you know, you can make as much on a dairy farm as you can in other types of jobs in the market.
Well, let's look at the effect here on consumers. So what do we know about what might happen if this this potential plan went into effect and you did have mass deportations?
Right. I mean, the fear is if you eliminated immigrant labor, and perhaps that's you know, unrealistic. We're not going to see all immigrant labor go away. But if you just substantially reduce the amount of workers, that means production would have to drop off from dairy farms. And this Texas A&M study did sort of some numbers crunching and came up with some calculations. If we did eliminate all immigrant labor, their calculation showed that about 1 in 6 dairy farms would close. We'd see about 208,000 jobs disappear, and more than 7,000 dairy farms in total would be closed because they couldn't get enough workers. And if you carry it out, you know, they found that the retail price of milk would actually increase by 90% for consumers if that happened.
And the price of milk is low right now, so I guess it's an interesting thing to see what that price might do. Americans, I guess, drink a lot of milk, don't they?
Right, and obviously milk also goes into other dairy products like cheese and yogurt, and those industries would also be affected because they rely on milk. And, you know, if the main ingredient, if the cost goes up, you know, these milk processors, dairy processors, really would have no choice but to pass those costs along to consumers as well. And it's, you know, this is all coming at sort of a tough time for dairy farms. They're already under pressure because wholesale prices for milk are less than half of what they were 2 years ago, because we've seen an increase in production faster than demand. So while, you know, a lower price for milk is good for consumers, you know, it's not great for farmers who are working off a low margin anyway.
Now, if this were to happen, again, a big if, but if dairy farmers did lose some of these immigrant workers, what happens? Do they spend more on machinery?
That's one option. You know, there is robotics out there. You know, robots can milk the cows. But, you know, the dairy farmers I talked to said, you know, that it can be an expensive proposition, you know, $200,000 or more for a robot to milk maybe 60, 70 cows. So if you have a large herd, you know, that's a lot of robots. And also it's not like you can just turn it on and let it go. You still have to have workers there to, you know, monitor the robots and operate them and so forth. And that still requires a workforce they're not sure they'd be able to fill. And, you know, ultimately, automation brings its own challenges, and it's a different kind of operation than what many dairy farmers want to have.
We're talking with Mark Niket, national government and politics reporter for Bloomberg News, talking about how a Trump presidency could have a chilling effect on the dairy industry here in Wisconsin, thanks to Trump's plan for mass deportations of immigrants.
And we want to hear from you. Could Donald Trump's stance on immigration affect your business or your livelihood? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe you work in the dairy industry or on a dairy farm. Tell us if Trump's proposed immigration legislation could affect you or the people you work with. The number is 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation now with Mark Niket, national government and politics reporter for Bloomberg News, talking about how a Donald Trump presidency calling for mass deportations of undocumented workers could affect the dairy industry here in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. Are you an employer who relies on undocumented employees? How might Trump's stance on immigration affect you? What should happen to industries that rely on undocumented labor? Let us know by calling 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Mark, before we get to our callers, you reached out to the Trump campaign. What did they tell you about this?
Well, essentially, they defended, you know, Mr. Trump's position on immigration because their argument is there are other costs to the country of illegal immigration, primarily welfare, health care costs, other types of costs that taxpayers have to pay. And, you know, their argument and others who, you know, study this issue would say, well, part of it is cheap labor, that if, you know, these farmers in this case would pay more, you know, there'd be less need for illegal immigrants to take those jobs. And overall, you know, more Americans would be working. And it's easier said than done, or it's an easier answer, because in some cases, like in dairy farming, you know, you're sort of limited by the commodity price. It's not like you can just pass along the cost, higher cost for labor to your customers. In this case, your costs are sort of determined by what the market will bear, and you have to factor in other, you know, costs for feed and whatnot. But, you know, Mr. Trump makes the case that, you know, I think his comment to us for the story was, you know, cheap labor isn't cheap, and that there are other costs to society as a result of having these immigrants in the U.S. labor force.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Stephen on the line in Exonia. Stephen, hi.
Hi. I wanted to point out that if the price of milk went up 90%, like your guest was saying, then they could easily pay the workers 90% more, since that's not even, it wouldn't even cause that much of an increase. So then they'd be at like $20 an hour, and I don't think they'd have any trouble filling the job. The whole thing is just a scare tactic to get people to believe that bringing in other workers doesn't affect the economy. Just make it follow the market economy. If they can't find workers, raise their rates.
Stephen, thanks a lot. And Mark, is it that simple? What do you say about the economics of this?
Well, it's probably not that simple because, again, there's a lot of factors at play to determine what the farmer's income will be. It's just not as simple as, you know, you raise the price of milk and, you know, the farmer's income doubles and you can then pay the workers more. I mean, as it stands now, the market is such that farmers, the money they're getting for their milk is at a 6 or 7 year low. Part of that's based on, you know, the oversupply we have in the market right now, and there's actually a lack of export opportunity for milk and milk products in Europe, which is causing sort of a glut on the market, sort of the old supply and demand principles at play. So, I mean, I think, you know, I think the farmers would tell you if they could pay more and still, you know, be as functional and profitable as they want, they would, but they're limited by what their costs are and what they're able to pay.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Jay in Livingston. Jay, hello.
Hello, thank you. Understanding that it's a radio show, I don't have time to go into all of the economics, but he is correct that agriculture is one of the very few economic models where the farmer has neither the control over his input prices nor any control over what he sells the product for, because it's typically a commodity. Having said that, the barrier to entry, and again, I am a grain farmer out of central Illinois, the barrier to entry is pretty low. And there's an old truism in farming that the surest cure for low prices is low prices, and the surest cure for high prices is high prices. What I mean by that is, if the Texas A&M study is correct and the milk prices would go up 90%, farmers who are already milking cows would simply buy more cows and milk more cows. People that didn't have cows but had the operation would buy cows, bring them in, and milk more cows. The price of milk, because it's a commodity, would drop.
Jay, thanks a lot for that comment. I appreciate that. And Mark, what do you say to that? That in a sense, the market would correct itself and some people would get into the industry who weren't in it and other people would expand and things would normalize.
Yeah, I guess it would be hard to predict. And one of the, you know, caveats with this study is it's trying to make calculations based on the loss of all immigrant labor, which, you know, isn't likely to happen, right? I think we would expect, you know, even if Mr. Trump were elected and pursued these policies, we wouldn't see a total decline in immigrant labor. And in fact, he has talked about, you know, putting together some kind of visa program that would allow legal immigration to fill some of these jobs. You know, the question, you know, is part of a broader argument and debate we need to have about immigration policy in this country, because as it stands right now, there are opportunities for what are called H-2A visas or temporary visas for, let's say, farm workers to come to work in the country. But these are typically short-term seasonal-type jobs. And in the case of dairy farmers, they need year-round workers. So I think, you know, again, it's hard to predict exactly how the market might respond to that scenario, which is a hypothetical, obviously. But I think the broader issue is, you know, we probably do need to have a debate and some action as a country to deal with our legal immigration process, because that obviously affects the illegal side as well.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Mark Niket, national government and politics reporter for Bloomberg News, and he talked to us about his recent report on the effect a Trump presidency with possible mass deportations could have on the dairy industry here in Wisconsin.
County officials in northern Wisconsin say the 908 beds available at residential treatment centers for young people struggling with drug or mental health issues aren't enough to meet the need. But as Daniel Kading reports, there's a state and national effort to keep kids at home.
16-year-old Lexi Lorbecki says doing drugs with mom was normal in her family. At 13, she started snorting meth. Lorbecki bounced between her grandparents, foster care, and group homes until one day she ran away with an older man she'd met on Facebook. He kept her high for weeks, but one day something clicked.
I was like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to be dead tomorrow probably if I keep up using every single day, not knowing how much I'm taking or what I'm taking.
Lorbecki ended up in a juvenile detention center where she waited months before getting into the residential treatment center Northwest Passage. Girls Program Coordinator Amanda Lundquist says the center offers therapies and a variety of programs to treat kids.
We have the underwater photography. We have In a New Light, which is kind of the regular photography. We have the Razzle Dazzle Groove Squad, which is the dance group.
Maybe we should try a different warm-up dance. Try the Cupid Shuffle?
Yeah.
Girls are letting loose as part of one afternoon dance session. Lundquist says they're creating a therapeutic environment that's different from home.
We're letting them kind of pick and choose what they want to put in their toolbox to be successful.
Douglas County Intake and Assessment Supervisor Doreen Wemus says they place children with the most severe behaviors at Passage, or one of the other 28 residential care centers in the state. But with the increase in drug use, that's become more difficult.
We've run into a lot of them that they just don't have space available. They're at their licensing capacity because, of course, they serve across the entire state and out of state also.
Demand for beds dropped off several years ago, and some centers cut back or closed, according to Linda Hall with the Wisconsin Association of Family and Children's Agencies.
That's one of the issues here, is that we have insufficient funding to expand beds and to attract and retain staff that will work very well with kids.
But Hall says there's also been a push at the national level to keep kids with their families rather than send them away from home. The Wisconsin Department of Children and Families says residential care may be appropriate for the 371 kids currently in treatment, but the state wants to avoid that and place kids in the least restrictive environments. Elizabeth Hudson is director of the Office of Children's Mental Health in Wisconsin.
We don't live in a bubble, so we're influenced by whatever our surroundings are. So that has to be a part of the healing process, is figuring out how the person who has changed their thinking can be re-embedded into the community or not removed at all.
The last biennial budget included close to $4 million to expand community-based programs that connect kids with a team of county, tribal, or private providers. A 2014 state report says kids served by these teams saved Wisconsin an estimated $3.7 million in residential treatment center costs. As for Lorbecki, she's heading home to her grandparents after a year in treatment.
It's amazing to be, like, leaving here, but in a way it's also scary to, like, know that everything out in the real world that I had to deal with a year ago is still there.
But she says the treatment center gave her the support she needed to stay clean and plans to stay that way. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.